I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. President Trump's COVID diagnosis, hospitalization, and medical treatment, including the cocktail of drugs he is reportedly taking, have raised questions about his mental and physical health and the 25th Amendment. Last Friday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi introduced legislation to create a commission to determine if a president can no longer carry out his or her duties. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called the proposal absurd. We asked Brand Cult to explain what the 25th Amendment means and whether it needs an update. He's a professor of law at Michigan State University, author of a book titled Unable, The Law, Politics, and Limits of Section 4 of the 25th Amendment. Brand Cult, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
Before we get to Section 4, which does bear an explanation, does the 25th Amendment, which was updated after the assassination of JFK, meet the challenge of this moment?
Well, I think it's fair to say that this moment has shown the limits of the 25th Amendment. The 25th Amendment does provide for transferring power away from a president who's incapacitated, but it raises the bar extremely high. So there was little chance that it was going to transfer just because the president went into the hospital or just because he took some drugs that might have affected his mood. But I think it's reasonable to ask whether that's okay, whether it's okay for the bar to be set so high.
Well, and it seems looking back in the 25th Amendment has been invoked several times, but it seems that it needs the cooperation of a president in order for it to be put into place. Do I have that right?
Yes. Yeah, so there are two disability provisions. There's Section 3, where it's totally up to the president. The president says when he's not okay, when he's unable, he passes power to the vice president. And then he says when he's okay again and takes power back. So again, it's totally up to him on both ends. Section 4 has never been invoked. That's when the vice president and the cabinet invoke it without the president's consent. Section 3 has been used three times. Section 4 has never been used.
And tell us about the times that Section 3 has been used.
So the first time was in 1985. President Reagan was getting cancer surgery on his colon, and he was going to be under general anesthesia for 8 hours, as it turned out. And so he handed power over to Vice President Bush. And this was partly in reaction to the fact that when he had been shot in 1981 and was also under general anesthesia then and was out of it for quite some time after, they hadn't invoked the 25th Amendment and in retrospect realized that that was a mistake. And then George W. Bush, on two occasions when he had colonoscopies, handed power over to Vice President Cheney for a couple of hours at a time.
What do you make of what House Speaker Nancy Pelosi did on Friday? She wants to set up a commission to determine if the president can govern. And she made it generic in that whether future president, whether it's a man or a woman, what is she trying to do from your perspective?
So there's two things going on here. One of them is political. There's no question that she was doing it to raise the issue of the president's ability to function. And that, as a political point, that wasn't ever going to go very far. Congress doesn't have a role in invoking the amendment. But the other thing she was doing was picking up an idea that's been kicking around in the 50-odd years since the amendment passed. Section 4, when it gives power to the vice president and the cabinet to say that the president is unable and to transfer power away, and when the president says that he's okay, they get to disagree, and if they do, it goes to Congress. The role of the cabinet there is what this proposal was directed at, because Section 4 says Congress can provide by law for someone other than the cabinet to fill this role. So really what she was saying was, we can't rely on the cabinet. The cabinet is too loyal to the president, too slow to act in these cases, and we need this independent commission.
And my understanding is what she was talking about was some kind of a bipartisan commission, what, separate from Congress, so not necessarily elected members of government?
Right. The proposal, Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland had been proposing this for some time, and this is basically his bill. And the idea is that the Speaker, the House Minority Leader, the Senate Majority Leader, the Senate Minority Leader, they would each appoint two doctors, one psychiatrist and one other physician. And then they would also each appoint people who had served at a high level in the executive branch before, former presidents or vice presidents, secretaries of state, surgeon generals. So there would be this commission of 16 people appointed in this bipartisan manner, and then the 16 of them on the panel would pick a 17th person as chair. It's this elaborate formulation, but the idea is it's independent. Unlike the cabinet, they're not beholden to the president. He can't fire them. And that there would be some medical knowledge represented on the commission instead of, again, leaving it to the cabinet.
Do you think it's a good idea, either today or looking into the future?
Well, you know, the framers of the amendment considered whether there should be a body like this, whether there should be official medical input, and they decided against it. And I think their reasons for deciding against it reflect the high bar that they set here for saying when a president is incapacitated. Section 4 is really meant for a situation, it works most easily in a situation when the president's completely incapacitated, when he's in a coma, where he can't invoke Section 3. And in that case, you don't need a doctor to say that someone who's in a coma is unable to discharge his powers. And when it's a more ambiguous situation, when the president's impaired, and the question is he so impaired that he's functionally incapacitated, they really designed it to be to err on the side of the president, to say that the vice president and cabinet, who are his own people, which they meant as a feature that they'd be reluctant to do this, have to agree that he's not better. If he says he's fine, his own people and then two-thirds majorities in the House and Senate, so substantial members of his own party in Congress, would have to agree. And they said it's fundamentally a political decision whether the president is up to the job, not a medical one. They imagined that these people would consult doctors in making these decisions, but they didn't want to leave it up to some unaccountable group of people.
Well, Pelosi and others have complained that there is a lot we don't know about President Trump's health status, his mental health status. But when you look back at history, there have been other presidents who've been really incapacitated. And I think it's President Wilson. And well, didn't his wife step in for a while, essentially run the country?
Yes, he had a very severe stroke. His doctor announced to the country that Wilson was unable to do his job. There wasn't a 25th Amendment back then. And so it was unclear how the vice president would step in. And so, yeah, his wife basically ran things. And when President Garfield was shot, there was no one in charge, essentially, for about 2.5 months.
So how does this fit in with impeachment? I mean, we're talking about a president unable to fulfill his or her duties.
So this is meant, they recognized when they set this up, the framers of the 25th Amendment recognized that they were providing another way to essentially get rid of a president, even though this only temporarily sidelines him. And so they wanted to make sure that this wouldn't be used as an end run around impeachment. And so impeachment's for when the president is doing bad things. 25th Amendment is more about when the president's unable to do anything. So if the president's doing bad things, you're supposed to use impeachment. And the way they structured it to make sure that that happened was by saying that if the president says that he's okay, that you need not only the vice president and cabinet, but two-thirds in the House, two-thirds in the Senate. Impeachment doesn't require that many votes on the House side. And so it's harder to do than impeachment and removal. And it's also not permanent like impeachment and removal would be. So they specifically designed it to be harder than impeachment so that it wouldn't be used instead of impeachment. It would really only be used for these situations of incapacity.
Did the framers understand psychology, mental health? Do we have evidence of that?
Yes, that was part of what they discussed. So I said if the president's in a coma, but they also discussed situations like a president who is mentally unbalanced, and they recognized that that would be a tricky situation. And it would be a tricky situation even if we had the Pelosi-Raskin Commission with psychiatrists on board, particularly if you can't examine the person and you're just going based on what you see them say or tweet.
So where does that leave us?
it's hard to amend the
Constitution. Nowheresville or what? I mean, kind of a stasis here?
Essentially, yes. But it leads us back to the structure of the Constitution, which is to say the 25th Amendment helps in an extreme situation. But barring that, if it's not going to work, as in this situation, it probably wouldn't because the bar is set so high. We still have impeachment if the president is doing things that are that problematic. And most importantly of all, we have elections, and they're coming up soon. So people can weigh in. If they don't think that the president is fit for duty, then they can express that at the ballot box.
But do you think there's a need to update the 25th Amendment or even have a new amendment to address this potential problem?
I look at this as someone who's studied constitutional history and recognized that it's extremely hard to amend the Constitution. We have one of the hardest to amend constitutions in the world. So It's hard for me to say, it's easy for me to say, but it's hard for me to believe that just saying, well, the Constitution doesn't work, we should just fix it, is really a realistic prescription, because it was really hard to pass the 25th Amendment, even after President Garfield and President Wilson. It took decades after that. Everyone recognized it was a problem, but it took decades after that to fix it. And I don't see us easily tweaking that, particularly when it's in the context of a particular president, because then people take sides. And you can't amend the Constitution unless you have a bipartisan consensus. It just doesn't work. You need too many votes.
Is that part of the strength of our Constitution, is that it is hard to amend? Do you see it that way?
I don't know. I think it's problematic because it's so hard to amend. We often have people finding ways to change it without amending it. And sometimes we like those and we applaud that, and sometimes we don't. But it is what it is. I don't think we deal as well with this as, say, a parliamentary system where they can just have a vote of no confidence, and it can be for any reason, and it's just the bottom line. Does this person have our confidence? So I think it's a problem that we can't adapt things as easily as we might, but I think that's probably also saved us from making some mistakes as well. So cuts both ways.
And we're almost out of time here. So do you see this going anywhere?
The Pelosi bill? No, I don't. The president would have to sign it. It's not going anywhere this Congress. A future president would have to take a very far-sighted, selfless approach and say, look, this is what we have now isn't working. And that's what President Eisenhower did. He recognized he had some health problems, that the Constitution didn't handle that very well. And he's really the one who got the ball rolling. So it would have to be leadership coming from the top before anything could change.
Well, Brian Cult, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. He's a professor of law at Michigan State University, author of Unable. After this very short break, we'll be joined by Cole Brown. He's got a new book. It's called Gray Boy, Finding Blackness in a White World. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Cole Brown says his new book, Gray Boy, is a scrapbook of stories taken from his life and from interviews with others who, like him, are young and black and grew up wealthy and privileged, living in largely white worlds. He attended private schools in Philadelphia. His family was a member of the cricket club. He summered in Martha's Vineyard and graduated from Georgetown University. Cole Brown calls people like him tokens, often described by their white friends as not really black, many times the only black person in the room, straddling two worlds but feeling like an outsider in both. He joins us on Radio Times to talk about his quest to define his identity. He is in Australia, where it is something like 1 a.m. And Cole Brown, joining us by Skype. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me. It was well worth staying up, I guess, to pretend like I'm back in Philly for a night.
Well, excellent. Excellent. Well, it's great to have you, and I appreciate the fact that you are up so early in the morning. Let's start with the title of your book, Gray Boy. Where did that come from?
So I borrowed that from a poem by Amiri Baraka. I was searching for epigraphs to go in the book and came across this poem called Letter to Half-White College Students. And in that poem, I think the quote is something like, are you sure you are not so full of Richard Burton that Elizabeth Taylor is coming out of your ears? Are you sure you are not an imitation gray boy? I might have paraphrased that slightly. But in the poem, he's really hypercritical of the population I'm talking about, you know, kind of token black kids that he doesn't think are black enough. And I really like the idea of borrowing that phrase and kind of turning it on its head, claiming that that grayness.
Well, did you take that personally, Amiri Baraka, writing about people like you?
I respect very much many of Amiri Baraka's writings, but he was not the first, nor will he be the last, I'm sure, to make claims like that. So no, I didn't take it too personally.
Well, it's funny. I was thinking of the color gray, you know, and thinking about the title and you and your story in this book and the color gray, which is, you know, is sort of a non-color in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I think that that's kind of the point. You know, there was. This is not a question of sort of denying that I am black, and some of the response to the title has been that, and I want to state that clearly. I am proudly, definitively black. The title more came from sort of external perception, the perception that myself and kids like the ones I'm describing in the book don't fit neatly into the stereotypes that we've constructed for people in our world, and therefore are, you know, left somewhat in between the two.
You also describe people like yourself as tokens, and we'll get beyond, you know, having you define terms and get into your story. But again, it's a loaded word that has many, many definitions. But token in what way?
Yeah, you know, I think at times, particularly in the past, there's been kind of a negative connotation around that word. I was really searching, and much of the language that we're talking about probably underscores this. I was searching for how to describe a people that aren't necessarily clearly defined, which is part of the thesis of the book. Token really, to me, just meant black kids in white spaces, often sort of white spaces of privilege that ensure that they don't see themselves reflected in their immediate environment for much of their lives.
Do you identify with the TV show Blackish?
Very much so. Actually, that TV show in some ways was one, my life, but two, kind of a dream come true. I felt for so long that I didn't see kind of a broad array of black narratives in media and mainstream media. And I think Blackish is one of several that have come up recently that are just expanding the way we think about blackness.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about, you grew up in Chestnut Hill, which is a very, very nice part of Philadelphia. Tell us a little bit about your family, your mom and your dad.
Yeah, I have two just hardworking parents. I don't think anybody in my family was sort of born into any privilege to speak of. And like many kind of black American families, particularly on my father's side, our lineage kind of disappears into the institution of slavery pretty immediately. My grandfather's father was sort of barely escaped slavery, was born shortly after emancipation. On my mother's side, I am Ethiopian. So Ethiopia has a slightly different history. It was never colonized, and therefore we can trace our lineage much further back. But my, you know, my family on that side still largely lives in Ethiopia, and I'm very much connected with that culture.
And is it your grandmother was a member of the government?
Yes, she was the first female senator of the country, which is something that I'm very proud of. And she continues to do a lot of work in that country. It's important to say, if you know a bit about Ethiopian history, you know, there was a communist sort of revolution at one point that caused her to flee the country. So when she ultimately returned, it wasn't in a position of government. She came to the U.S. as a refugee and was only able to return many years later.
I'd love to have you read a section from the book. I picked it out. It's on page 20, just for our listeners, just to get a sense of how you write, frankly, and how you describe a little bit of what it was to be you growing up.
Yes, happy to. Chestnut Hill isn't exceedingly unique, and I'm far from alone. We not really black kids are sprinkled about. You can find us in Beverly Hills and Greenwich and Buckhead and the Gold Coast and the Upper West Side and all other enclaves of wealth that were formerly forbidden. You can find us in South Orange and Prince George's County and Baldwin Hills, enclaves we've carved out ourselves. We are deposited at the Deerfields and the Andovers of the world to learn their ways and speak in their tongues. We're taught to fake the funk until it's hard to remember which funk is our own. And then, when we are good and ready, we infiltrate Harvard's halls, climbing ladders of prestige that were not erected for our purposes. I was rejected from Harvard twice, but you get the point.
I was going to ask you about that. Again, that's Cole Brown, our guest on Radio Times today. We're talking about his new book. It's called Gray Boy Finding Blackness in a White World. It's such a dumb question. I mean, your family's black. You're black. But when did you become, how old were you when you had a kind of consciousness of the color of your skin?
So I think that kids, and actually research shows, frankly, that kids began to develop an awareness of race pretty early on. So even if I didn't really know kind of the consequences of being black in that world, I did know that I was different, I think, as early as, you know, second, third grade, mm-hmm. In part because my parents intentionally attempted to hand down those lessons. You know, they wanted to sort of preemptively prepare me for that world before that world handed down lessons of its own that would be much less kind. So in the third grade, second grade, fourth grade, I remember, and I write about this in the book, my parents sort of developing these reading lists and book reports to write on really complex black literature that I doubt many third graders are reading. But they wanted me to learn that history and learn that culture early on. And then I think that it shifts slightly when you get to middle school. I think that then it becomes a bit more toxic in some ways, sure. Frankly, a bit more difficult to grapple with.
And I do want to get to that. Did your parents, you know, there's the talk that black parents have with their children. Did your parents have that almost now stereotypic talk with you?
Absolutely. I think that early on, I don't remember it as explicitly when I was young, but I do remember, and I think I might mention this in the book, is I was one of those kids that had just an insane growth spurt. Between seventh and eighth grade, I grew like 8 inches or something.
Wow.
And I remember my mother during that time, just the fear that she felt that, you know, just in the span of those 8 inches, I would have gone from a black boy to a black man. And that was when all of a sudden we began to have that talk pretty frequently. Just her attempting to ensure that I was prepared for how the world was now going to look at me.
Including sort of anonymous strangers, how they might look at you, how you might have some kind of interaction with the police, things like that?
Yeah. In fact, especially anonymous strangers and how they might look at me, and especially the police. I think that the concern is less so about those that knew me. I think that, you know, she sort of had faith in the kid that she had raised in that perspective. But I think that she was concerned about, one, just like the bodily harm that could come from people perceiving me as a threat, but two, what that would do to my confidence. I mean, even if it's not sort of a police officer accosting me, which has happened, but equally as damaging to my confidence could be, you know, a friend's parent that has never met me before, you know, clutching her purse or something. And I think that my mother was really concerned about how I would interpret that as it began to happen.
Did that happen too?
Yes,
someone clutching
not an invented example. Yes, things like that. And that specific example, but also sort of microaggressions of that general ilk, you know, wouldn't be foreign to any kind of black man walking through America, frankly, certainly not me.
But are you good at what we call code switching? I mean, you know, being black, but living in many ways, as we describe in these, you know, rather privileged white worlds. Do you have that kind of passport that allows you to go back and forth today, now?
You know, I think that, and I talk about code switching a lot these days, and I think that that term, it kind of fits uncomfortably to this narrative. Mm-hmm. And here's why: is because code switching is often discussed in terms of, you know, being clearly from one culture and having to leave behind many of those cultural markers in order to gain acceptance into another culture, right? So it's often, you know, sort of being clearly from a Black culture and entering white spaces. I don't know that that as clearly fits here, only because, you know, those white spaces were home to me.
Yeah.
You know, Chestnut Hill was where I grew up. So just as I was as much at home in, you know, the Black spaces that I was in Ethiopia and my cousin's homes and so forth, I was also at home in Chestnut Hill. I mean, those weren't lessons that had to come later in life for me.
You tell a story of, I guess, being a teenager and going to a party at a friend's house. The cops come and raid the party, and the kids are there, and the police officers say, well, how many of you have parents who are either lawyers or judges? A lot of the hands went up. What happened next?
So we essentially got off scot-free. You know, we got basically a slap on the wrist and told we could go home. And immediately before that, I'm sure you were going to bring this up, but immediately before that, my close friend and I were basically accosted in the party and put on the ground by the cops. And we were also, you know, the only two Black partygoers. And that entire sequence of events seemed like a stark depiction of kind of our positionality in that world, that privilege could sort of save us from a lot. You know, it saved everybody in the room that day from you know, whatever consequences might have come. But when things sort of really came down to it, it couldn't save us from a pretty brutal interaction.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it tells both those stories. On the one hand, treated one way, but on the other hand, having this sort of armor of privilege that at least you didn't end up in prison or jail, I should say.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
How about having white friends and Black friends, and you talk a lot about sort of, again, straddling these two worlds, feeling both part of these worlds and not part of these worlds. How different were those relationships, or were they any different, the relationships you would have with a white friend versus a Black friend?
I think they're very different. I think they were then and are now. I talk a bit about the Black table in the book. There's a chapter called The Black Table.
And, at Penn Charter, Charter
at
School.
Yep, at Penn Charter, absolutely. And the Black table was both sort of a literal physical table in the corner of the lunchroom, but it was also all of us that sat around that table. We were the Black table. And my migration to the Black table is to this day kind of a monumental moment in my life. Because those relationships that I had there, you know, it was a space that I could go to decompress. It was a space that I could go to have honest conversations with people that would understand what I was saying about some of the events that we were dealing with, both, mm-hmm. you know, like very significant in terms of, you know, for instance, the house party incident that we just discussed, but also, you know, like minor comments that might happen in the locker room. That was a place where they could be discussed. And I don't think that those same discussions could have happened in, you know, within my white relationships.
And was it just grays at the Black table, or was it, as you describe, there are a lot, you know, a number of scholarship kids that go to private schools?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the kids that sat around that table, at the Black table, frankly had little in common other than the fact that we were all Black. But that was enough to kind of glue us together, that, you know, because of the fact that we were Black and operating in a space that was so clearly not kind of designed for our purposes. We shared enough that we could, you know, we could make the rest up. We could figure the rest out. And to this day, those are kind of my closest ties on this earth.
Interesting. So for the white friends that you had, there was this kind of racial barrier. I mean, you described some of them saying, you know, that you're not really like other Black people. It's feeling as if for some reason that would be a compliment, but help us understand what that dynamic is about.
Yeah, I think that that's a comment that I heard so frequently. You're not really black. You're not like the others. You're an exception, blah, blah, blah. That it took me, frankly, a lot of years and probably some growing up before I understood what bothered me so deeply about it. And I think it's this, that comment was so often made in response to some positive quality they were identifying in me, that they saw as positive, the way I speak, the way I eat, the way I dress, whatever it might be. And to make the mental leap from, you know, you contain that positive quality and therefore you are not black, really what you're saying is then that, you know, blackness must be the negative qualities.
Yeah.
And that's a loud proclamation about my people, about me, about who we are. And I think that bridge, that connection between sort of a flippant comment and kind of the larger truth is something that few people stop to analyze and think about.
About a minute before our break here, but you interviewed other so-called grays, you know, kids like yourself or young people like yourself. Did they have that same kind of experience?
Absolutely. And I think it's important to underscore that this isn't just a memoir. It's many of my stories, but I was very intentional about bringing in stories from other people for that exact reason, because I wanted to draw the clear lines between our experience and make clear that this is an experience, not just sort of my individual narrative.
And you call it a scrapbook. I mean, that's sort of your landing definition, I
yes.
guess, right?
if it's not clear, I was not kind of a writer going into this. I was making it up along the way, which is probably part of the reason it took me 4 years to get through this book. And I landed on scrapbook only because, as you would have read, on many of the chapters, I kind of drop you in the middle of it and intentionally try to let the reader find his or her way out and piece together many, many different narrative threads between myself and you know, many people that grew up like me, hoping that sort of in aggregate understanding is contributed.
Well, let's take a short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Cole Brown. We're talking about his new book, Gray Boy, Finding Blackness in a White World. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Cole Brown, and he grew up in Philadelphia, the Chestnut Hill section of Philadelphia, attended private schools, summered on Martha's Vineyard, graduated from Georgetown University, and his new book, Gray Boy, is about straddling black and white worlds and feeling like an outsider in both. Cole, I'd love to have you read another section. We're going to go from the Black Table to Martha's Vineyard, but I want to have you just read a paragraph about what it's like for you and perhaps others to enjoy what Martha's Vineyard offers to Black families.
It is on Martha's Vineyard that I, too, feel most myself, most average. Day-to-day ruminations on Blackness, constantly calculating the role your precise level of Blackness plays in every interaction, wears you out. It's exhausting. The vineyard is a space to exhale. A feeling of relief washes over me when her painted porches and buzzing beaches enter view. It is physically felt. It's like those final moments before slumber, pulse slowing to a lazy thud, muscles once tightly wound unraveling on their spools, and a breath containing the day's worries weaseling away through parted lips. The relief comes with knowledge that for the coming days I will be my whole self. The vineyard is a home as Maya Angelou describes it should be, the safe space where we can go as we are and not be questioned. That is why we flock. That is the warm sensation we yearn for, acceptance.
And again, that's Cole Brown reading from his new book, Gray Boy. My understanding is, and I know that African-American families have been going to Martha's Vineyard for generations now, but it is a place for the privileged Black families. Is that part of what it felt like for you there?
That is certainly a fact. I think that, you know, to kind of, I think I mentioned this, to quote unquote summer anywhere,
yes.
You have to, you know, you have to kind of leap a certain financial barrier. There's no doubt about that. But to ask sort of, is that what it felt like for me? No, only because the time in my life that I'm describing is me as a kid. And it wasn't, that just wasn't what it was about. I think that there are really serious questions to be asked about sort of the elitism that perhaps is present in those spaces. And I try to ask some of those questions, but it's not the job of kids to ask those questions. As a kid, what was most important to me was just finding a place where I felt I belonged and was accepted.
And where you could relax and just, I guess, not feel a kind of self-consciousness that you might have felt in the other parts of your life.
Exactly. You know, the kids that I met there in that space struggled with similar things. And I understand kind of the impulse to be patronizing about to even use that term struggle in the context of Martha's
sure.
Vineyard. I really do get that. But I think that we were all just trying to figure out our identities and where our own blackness played into that. And that was a space for us to kind of do that together.
I'm glad you raised that because, you know, whether I'm curious about whether in any way you have felt like a victim as a black man growing up in these various white worlds.
Let me state definitively on your program.
Please do.
No, I do not. I do not at any point. I have not at any point felt like a victim. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons that this book was difficult for me to write and one of the reasons it took so long is because it's hard to describe these things and not sound sort of like, woe is me, I'm privileged. That really is not the impression I tried to leave. And it's not how I feel. Really, I'm just trying to dissect what is a nuanced black experience and hopefully one of many kind of legitimate black experiences.
And I should tell you, I don't get that feeling in reading your book that that's how you feel. But, you know, as you said, this is a nuance and in many ways a complicated situation. You've also written, this was a piece in a, I'm not sure what the exact journal was, but anyway, I grew up in Philadelphia, a place where urban life is synonymous with black people, my people. I grew hypersensitive to each side eye and rude remark. I awaited the racist confrontation that would certainly soon arrive, but one never did. Talk a bit about what Philadelphia means to you as part of your identity.
As I think many people from Philly would say, Philly is a crucial part of my identity. And I think that Philly, at least the way I experienced Philly, was that it didn't feel sort of segregated as much as some of the other cities that I've lived in have been, frankly. Since leaving Philly, I've spent time in D.C. at Georgetown and then Chicago, now Sydney, Australia. And Philly, I was able to sort of cross cultural lines in a way that I didn't in some of those other spaces. So it did feel like, you know, sort of the many different facets of the city were readily accessible to one. I like to think more so than many other places.
And you loved Allen Iverson. I mean, many ways who didn't, but you know, for you, you identified with him on, I guess, on and off the court.
Yes. So I write about Allen Iverson because Allen Iverson, I mean, I was born in 1995, so I grew up, you know, very much in the Allen Iverson era. And as you said, I mean, I loved Allen Iverson, but who didn't? But the reason I bring him up in the context of the book, one, as a fan, but then two, to say sort of that in so many ways, he was a black male stereotype, that so many kids that I knew didn't know blackness outside of what they knew of Allen Iverson. And Allen Iverson was wicked on the court and had a rap career. And, you know, like, he was in so many minds the stereotype. Again, I'm a fan, but that just wasn't sort of my expression of blackness. That wasn't who I was. And I think that people often tried to overlay the Allen Iverson template onto me, and it just didn't really fit.
You describe, and it's, I mean, teenage years are hard for anybody, and you certainly had some struggles in your teenage years to the point where you described yourself as feeling unattractive, even ugly, even called ugly. Help us understand what that was like for you, how you experienced that.
This is another one that I think is easy to feel patronizing about. And I'm not saying others, I'm saying even me, looking at, reflecting on an earlier self, it's easy to kind of look back and say, oh, that was stupid teenage stuff. But I will say that I think that when you're in those years, sort of, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, kids begin to realign what, you know, how they value each other, how we perceive value in one another. And particularly as kind of relationships between boys and girls develop. And that's not necessarily an easy time to be the one that sort of clearly physically stands out. And I think that was just some of the stuff I was wrestling with were byproducts of so clearly not fitting in many of those spaces.
Do you feel like you fit now or fit better?
I feel like it doesn't matter. I feel like okay. It matters less. I mean, you know, I talk about, and this is one of the things that I try to get to by the end of the book is that I'm comfortable now in these spaces. And that comfort comes from kind of knowing much better who I am. I think that part of that comes with growth. That's a long journey, but I think that I just think that it matters less than it once did.
How about dating? And you write about, and you dated a couple of white girls, you've dated black girls as well. Help us understand that experience for you. And you even describe a black woman sort of challenging you on your choice of dating white women.
So that was a difficult chapter for me to write. That chapter took essentially the entire 4 years for me to write. Because I think that's a conversation that black men often screw up. And I really didn't want to add my voice to the many others that have screwed that conversation up. And what I was trying to get at there was sort of, in one hand, the love, admiration, and respect I have for both black women writ large, but also sort of the specific black women that have been in my life, both dating counterparts, but also my mother, my sister, the many aunties. And feeling that firmly, and feeling as firmly, and as authentically, a real deep sort of love and admiration for two specific non-black women. And those are two sort of qualities and emotions that are often seen as necessarily being in conflict, and trying to get my words around a way to explain that. You know, I can contain both of those and hopefully pay appropriate homage to both sides.
Again, you quote this friend, and I mean, she takes it personally. I mean, she says, Cole, it hurts when after all that you won't support us the way we support you. Sort of saying that, you know, black women have supported black men, but it hasn't been returned in equal measure.
And I really thought it was important to put that in because, you know, we ultimately, the friend that you're quoting there, we ultimately don't really come to a place of agreement, frankly, at the end of that conversation. But I know that opinion, that view is an authentic one and a real one and one that, like, is hard to argue with on the facts. You know, like, it's hard to, all I can really respond with is my own emotions. So I knew that was an important opinion. And this goes back to the point of sort of trying to capture an experience rather than just my memoir. I knew that was an opinion that is shared by many and deserved to be included here.
You're in Australia, and as we know, we've had a summer and even into the fall of protests. A number of black men who've been either killed or incarcerated or shot, Michael Brown, Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice. I mean, it's a long list. You call out a UVA student, a guy named Martiz Johnson. He was an honor roll student, and he had an altercation with the police. Tell us what happened and why you connected with his particular experience.
So Martiz, as you mentioned, was an honor student at UVA, and I think the scenario was essentially he tried to get into a bar with a fake ID, as many college students at UVA or any other college do, and the cops come and essentially beat him up. And I think part of the reason that this went to sort of national news, not on the level of some of the others that you mentioned, but was national news, is because there's images of him where he's sort of yelling and screaming and cursing at the cops while he's on the ground. And there's clearly blood streaming from his face. And he's been roughed up in a serious way. And I talk about, I try to wrestle with the fact that sort of on the one hand, this one incident resonated really strongly, not just with me, but with the many people that I interview for the book. You know, unprompted, people sort of brought this up over and over again. And I understand that. I get that. You know, I'm talking to kids that are at school similar to UVA, and they see Martise and they say, that could be me, perhaps in a way that they didn't as strongly in some of the other cases. But then I struggle with the fact that, you know, in the headlines, Martise is essentially tied to white legacy. He's tied to UVA. You know, the headlines were always black UVA student, blah, blah, blah. And it, I don't love what it says about us, that is needed, that he must be tied to white legacy in order to sort of feel that deeply personal fear that might not have been felt in other cases.
But his cry was, I go to UVA.
Right. And that was part of the point that actually I tried to make in the book, in the chapter, is that there's this understanding, misunderstanding, that things like that can be a shield, can be a cloak, can protect us. This goes back to the house party conversation we were having a moment ago. And it's an abrupt, brutal realization. We might not all sort of confront it the way that Martise does, but I think that there is for many of us, for all of us, a realization at a certain point that all of these, you know, all of these things that we've attempted to cloak ourselves in, privilege and sort of white legacy and UVA and whatever else, are not always sufficient when in the most dire of circumstances.
What are you doing in Australia? How did you end up there?
I it's actually a simple story. I came here for a job. So I came here in February, and actually the piece that you quoted earlier was written for the Sydney Morning Herald here in response to some of the stuff that I'm watching back home that I'm deeply concerned about.
And as you watch from your vantage point in Australia, what do you see happening in America?
It's disturbing, and I think that it's disturbing. I mean, the overlay of Australia is perhaps important because I think, one, just the effect that so much American misbehavior over the American summer, the effect that is having on our reputation on the global stage, I think that I have perhaps a greater appreciation from here than I would there. I'm really concerned about our ability to ever bounce back from that. But then two, there's just, you know, there's just like the hopelessness, there's the despair, there's the concern of seeing these headlines, that kind of shout loudly that Rome is burning, and having no lived experience on the ground to determine whether or not that's true. And everyone I know and love is still there. And just concern about them.
We're almost out of time. Will you be coming back then?
I will. Very soon, hopefully to Philly.
And are you a writer now, having written a book?
I don't know that I get to call myself a writer just yet, but I do think that this is something that'll be in my life for a long time. So there's a couple other projects I'm working on now, and hopefully, you know, hopefully this will continue. I've been pleasantly surprised by how the first one went.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Cole Brown, talking to you, and especially from Philadelphia, and having you as a guest on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marty. I really appreciate this.
Absolutely. The book is called Gray Boy, Finding Blackness in a White World. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.